Welcome to the Spitball Sessions. Here we talk about game mechanics, the games we want to see, how to make them, and the games that come close, and how to fix them. We might even talk about the games we love along the way. We have two wonderful hosts, Josh Noyes and Luke Boulay. After the first part's done, we go on to the mouthwash, where we go off the cuff and talk about some random stuff. The topic of this week... Fishing Games.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Spitball Sessions, where you must defeat your games to complete your games. My name is Josh, and I'm the reviews writer and the lead editor at NeonCheetahs.com, home of Faster Than Bright Gaming. I'm joined by Neon Cheetahs designer and webmaster, as well as the Rainmaker Okada to my Kenny Omega, Luke. Luke, how's the site been?
Pretty good. I haven't seen any major fires, so I'm pretty happy.
Did you check out my article about fire starting?
Did you do something about fire on the website? Do I have to break out the fire extinguisher again, Josh?
Well, either that or the flamethrower. One or the other.
Well, yeah, flamethrower, fire extinguisher, same difference. They do the same thing, right?
Yes, I'm pretty sure that's exactly how that works. Thank you, Luke. For those of you who are wondering at home what Spitball Sessions is all about, if you didn't hear, catch the lovely tones of our intro man, Trevor. We take ideas and concepts, try to filter out which parts of them are gems, and then discuss how those could be used to make interesting games, or how to take a rough game and cut and polish it into a true diamond. Today, we're going to be looking at an interesting topic, a slight diversion, actually, from the way we've sort of been doing things so far, because rather than starting with looking at a game or a game mechanic, we're actually going to start by talking about a real-world concept and how to make that more game-like, which is I want to talk a little bit about realistic fishing games versus interesting fishing games. And the thing that sort of got me thinking about some of this is, well, the two things. First of all, I've been working on an article about realism versus verisimilitude, which technically are defined the same way, but I'm still in the planning stages of this article, so I don't want to give too much away yet. But basically, the argument is that trying to make games more realistic at the expense of fun is always a bad idea.
Oh, I second that, definitely.
A lot of people really like realism, and, they always want games to be more realistic, but I find that really there's a good balance can be found between realism and, you know, things that are interesting. And the other thing that has been making me think a lot about this is Stardew Valley, because I've been playing that a lot, and I didn't at first like the Stardew Valley fishing game.
Well, yeah, I can understand that. I mean, Stardew Valley's fishing, and for those of you who haven't played, it is a mini game built into the major game, kind of like something that they threw in just because they thought it would be fun to include. One of the major flaws with Stardew Valley is the fishing mechanic is the fact that it is really hard in the beginning of the game, because as you advance through the game, the mechanics improve, like as you upgrade your fishing rod and other kit, your ability to catch fish gets better. But when you actually play, the fish don't change. So you can go to a specific spot and actually hook a really difficult fish and have absolutely no chance of catching it, which is supremely frustrating.
Yeah, I'm actually in the middle right now of writing an article about sort of the... some of the changes between Stardew Valley and the Harvest Moon series, which it borrows a lot of inspiration from, and the fishing mechanic is actually one of the big things, because I actually don't feel that the mechanic itself is necessarily broken. The more that I've played it, the more I come to believe that it's actually an issue of messaging, of the way that all the rest of that game works is one very specific way, but that the way that Stardew Valley shows you how you think the fishing game will work based on the way that the rest of that game works is different, where everything else you do is a pass-fail. You either succeed or you don't. Whereas with fishing, there's a dexterity element, and there's a little more going on behind the scenes. So there's a big in-depth there will be by the time this goes up, a big in-depth article over on Neon Cheetahs about Stardew Valley as a whole. It's going to be a very interesting article, and by interesting, I mean probably going to get me a lot of death threats from 12-year-olds who really, really love Stardew Valley.
And my wife.
And your wife. Hey, look, I like Stardew Valley. I've played a lot of it. I think there are some things that are some of the things that are changed between Stardew Valley and Harvest Moon are very good. I think some of them kind of miss why Harvest Moon was interesting.
That's always going to be the thing about this type of podcast and the type of thing that we're into doing is to properly find things that you can improve. You have to be willing to view and see what is really wrong with even some of the best games out there.
You have to be willing to deconstruct things. And deconstructing things is guaranteed to get some people upset because you're basically burning, you know, you're burning the sacred cow.
Okay.
Thank you. Let's start with... When I was growing up, my grandfather actually bought me a fishing game. You remember the old, like, Taiko or Tiger games that had, like, the black...
Yeah, yeah.
The little black things on... It was basically, like, LCDs. It was like an updated Game & Watch.
Yeah, like the Game & Watch style game.
Yeah. So they made a fishing for game like that. It came with a fishing pole that had a screen, and you actually reeled in the fishing pole, and, it was a short fishing pole. It was, like, probably, like...
I think I remember seeing that in your house somewhere or something.
It basically was, there was a fish on the screen, and based on the direction the fish was pulling, you pulled the handle of the fishing rod left or right. So if the fish was on the left, you pulled right, and if the fish was on the right, you pulled left. And it was all about reeling in the fish.
Do you hear that, people? Early game day motion controls. Yes, Nintendo did not pioneer motion controls.
No, and actually, even better, the fishing rod actually pulled. Like, there was a little pulley in there that would pull on the string of the fishing pole, so it felt like the fish
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, you actually had to, like, pull on it. Like, it actually could tell how hard you were pulling, and if you pulled too hard, the line would snap and you'd lose the fish. So, it was really early motion controls. So, here's the problem. Because I had that game. My grandfather really, really loves fishing, I should point out. Really, really loves it. And my cousin actually used to be a fly fishing instructor and designer for L.L. Bean. So fishing runs in my family. Everybody in my family has been fishermen up until me. They, like, professionally.
Up until you.
Professionally. I took a different path. But,
Plays video games about fishing.
Well, I don't live on the ocean the way that the entire rest of my family does. So it's a little easier for them to go lobstering than it is for me to go lobstering. You know, I don't have to drive 200 miles. So the thing is, I had that one, and I had another game that was about you going out, and you were in a little boat, and it was a PC game, and you used your mouse to click where you wanted the fishing line to go, and then you'd wait a few seconds, and a fish would bite, and you'd reel it in, because every fishing game I've ever played, that's what you do. You throw your line out, you wait a few seconds, you click on it, and then you, whether it be Stardew Valley, whether it be this fishing pole game, whether it be whatever game it is, 80% of the game is reeling the fish in properly.
Yes. Well... Okay, so there's that shtick of fishing games where it is just like a random cast and then properly reeling in the fish.
Right.
Then there's also another type that I just came to my mind that's a different... It goes in a different direction. It's more of what you probably would have expected from Stardew Valley. And the biggest example of that is actually World of Warcraft, where it was just a timing game where you cast into a spot that was for fishing.
Sure.
And then there, you would wait till the rings lined up or something goofy like that.
Yeah.
And then you
Torchlight does it too.
And then Torchlight is another good example of that. And then you click with the right timing and you'll get something.
Right. So that's how Harvest Moon does it too. And that's actually what I wanted from Stardew Valley.
That would have been a far more appropriate.
But here's the thing. And this is what I'm saying. Every fishing game that I have ever played, 80% of it is about the catching. Because that's what everybody thinks of as being the fun and... it's the most exciting part, sure.
Well, you know, that's kind of funny. I was about to say, and I realized how stupid it would have been for me. Nobody thinks about the half hour of sitting there with your line in the water waiting. But then I thought, wait a second. No, that's wrong. That's why I go fishing.
Right.
I picked up fishing in the past 2 or 3 years again.
Right.
After not doing it since my dad used to take me out as a little kid. And then I realized when I started doing it that the most important part of the fishing for me, who's not fishing for food, was just going out somewhere quiet and peaceful, casting a line, sitting back, and waiting for something to bite.
Right.
Because it's so relaxing. You don't do anything but just wait for a fish.
Well, here's the problem. I can think of two problems with that. Mm-hmm. First of all, that part is not a game.
No,
that's called
not.
A screensaver.
Well, that is also, like, on a timeline.
Also, I think that just shows that you and I are getting old.
Well, yes.
But
that's actually kind of depressing when you put it that way.
No, I think that's fine. I also enjoy relaxing times too. I prefer to do mine out in the woods as opposed to out in the fishing, out on the lake.
You know what I want to actually?
Oh, go ahead.
I want to pause it as a great example of a good fishing game.
Yes.
Even though it was a mini game and it's not very often thought of,
mm-hmm.
especially when it involved the canoe. But The Legend of Zelda: Twilight Princess,
yes.
The fishing mini game in that was actually very good.
That was
very
fun.
Robust. The reeling part of it wasn't too challenging,
mm-hmm.
and when you got to play with the lures,
yes.
you could get some fun results. And it still had that peaceful feeling that you got from casting and waiting to catch something and thinking about where you wanted to catch to get good fish.
Or you've hit upon the point that I was going for, which is there's a lot more to fishing than A, reeling in the fish. I mean, obviously, reeling in the fish is important. It's the payoff. It's the it's the denouement. It's the exciting moment at the end of the fish.
It's the climax.
It's the climax. It's what, you know, if it was a story, that would be the final scene, right? But there's so much more to fishing than that, or even just the sitting there.
Well, it's just like any other good story.
Right.
Essentially, it's like if you were to look at the what is it called, the climax curve of, like, say, Star Wars, as
right.
an example, it peaks and it drops as things get interesting and dumb,
right.
and then it climbs up to the climax and ends. If it was just flat and then peaked up to the climax,
right.
it wouldn't be a very good story.
Right. And it wouldn't. And
we're telling the story of fishing.
Well, we're not, but what I'm saying is all everybody looks at is the middle half of fishing. They look at the, oh, you sit there and nothing happens. And then you catch a fish, and it's really exciting for 30 seconds, and then you go back to sitting there staring at your fishing line. But because I think most people have done a limited amount of fishing, they go out fishing two or three times, they go out with their family, whatever mm-hmm. it may be, and I'm going to guess they probably go either like tuna fishing, or not tuna fishing, but they go like mackerel fishing, they go fishing, you know, like a lake, they have one, they go with worms, and that's all they have. But there's a lot to fishing before you even get to the lake. You know, if you're a serious fisherman, if you're mm-hmm. not just a weekend hobbyist fisherman who goes out occasionally. Like, my grandfather has an entire toolbox full of tackle, whether it be, you know, he has five or six different weights of lines, he has a half dozen different fishing poles, he has different types of lures, different types of flies, different weights, different bobbers. You know, if you want to think of it as, you know, think of it like an RPG, think of that as your inventory. There's a whole lot that goes into properly, or like a strategy game. If you think of that as your strategy toolbox, there's a whole lot that goes into preparing to go properly fishing.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm not 100%, I mean, as I'm saying this out loud, I'm not necessarily sure that you could make that into an interesting game in the sense of a first-person shooter or a first-person style game where you're going out fishing for fish, and then half of the game, because if half of the game is picking out stuff out of your inventory, that's not going to be a very exciting game. Not everybody likes playing inventory Tetris the way that I do.
I actually had a concept for a game that I was thinking about putting together that was essentially inventory Tetris.
I feel like if you took Tetris and made a game, If you took Tetris with inventory blocks, inventory items, that would be really fun.
I'll have to explain it to you. I'd love to talk about it in this podcast, but I don't think this podcast is a place to discuss this idea that I have.
Wait, this is the pitch podcast. We pitched. No, I'm just kidding.
It's not a fishing game. We're talking about fishing games.
What, you mean this is a Tangent, the podcast? We should have just called it
Tangent. Yeah, we should have just called it The Tangent. That would have been great. It probably exists already, though.
It probably does. But, you know, like, I think that actually, in much the same way as a strategy game, I mean, a lot of what makes fishing interesting is the strategy of it, if you will. You know, if you're going after trout, you want to be going to cold rivers. You want to be using very fragrant or pungent, depending on your views of the smell, very pungent baits. You want to be moving it a little bit.
There's if you're not me, because I am that weekend warrior you talked sure. about, who goes out with a hook and hopes something will bite it.
Right.
Doesn't really do any planning. But, like, what you're saying here, you are right. If you want to catch fish,
right.
if you're looking to do that as, like, that's your goal, to get some cool fish and what do whatever you want to, cook them, eat them,
right.
or just set them go and take pictures or whatever, then you do. You have to do this planning, there's preparation, mm-hmm. there's research. There's so much more to it than just going out there and throwing a line, which actually is kind of why the majority of mini games out there that have to do with fishing are kind of
mini games.
So weak.
Well, they're mini games.
Yeah.
As a mini game, throw the bait, catch the fish. It's a 30-second process. They have boiled down the exciting parts of because here's the reality: fishing games don't sell anymore. Cabela's hunting games don't even sell anymore, and those at least have guns in them.
They're very niche market. I won't say that because I have a friend who is an avid hunter and he loves it, and he has Cabela's games.
Oh, sure, but it's a very niche market. But
just like the fishing games, it's only for people who are really, really into hunting. Because like I'm a gamer, but I'm never gonna pick up Cabela's.
Sure.
Because I'm not that interested. If I want to get into hunting,
yeah.
I'm going to go get a gun. I'm going to go get a hunting license. I'm going to do everything I need. I'm going to go hunting.
I'm going to go get a slingshot personally. I've always wanted to try slingshot hunting.
You want a bow. Slingshot's not going to do the job. Well, unless you're hunting rabbits.
Yes, that's what I was going. Well, pheasants.
But you still want bow hunting is the place to
I know.
Be. It's a good medium. Because like, if you get like a 70-pound bow, you can hunt moose.
I know. I just really want a hunting slingshot, so I want an excuse to use.
Oh, okay. Yes. Well, that's what you want.
Yes. But again, we're not talking about hunting games either. We will discuss those, because I think...
Tangent the podcast.
No, I actually genuinely think hunting games, there are better ways, there are other ways that we could look at those too. I don't think that is actually so much of a tangent as it seemed at first, because the reality is there is actually a lot of in many ways, fishing is hunting in the water, mm-hmm. you know. And because, again, the part that the people who played a lot of Oregon Trail think of as hunting is you go out into the field with a gun and you shoot things for 10 minutes and you come back with 50 pounds of buffalo. Or 500 pounds of buffalo.
Yeah.
Depending on how good you are at Oregon Trail.
I'd say when it comes to, and it's kind of a weird thing to say, when it comes to like misrepresenting a thing,
yeah.
Fishing mini games at least, they're the worst.
But as somebody who has gone hunting, you know, and you know, if you there was a really good game. What was can you try to look it up real quick for me so get the exact name of it? But it was called like the Deer Hunter or something, or the Hunter. I think it may just be called the Hunter. I remember the Gamers with Job guys wrote an amazing article about it a few years ago, and literally 80% of that game is walking around in the woods looking for deer poop and animal poop and following it and trying to track the animals and figuring out where they would go based on the scent ranges and all these kinds of things. And I actually think that that is a much more accurate representation of what hunting really is. Certainly far more than Oregon Trail.
I think you're right.
Yeah, The Hunter.
It is called The Hunter.
Yeah. And
they have a spinoff called The Hunter Primal where you hunt dinosaurs.
Well, there you go. But I mean, that game is all about, you know, looking for various animals and their excrement and tracking them, which is what 80% of hunting actually is. It's not just standing out there or sitting out there. Well, for some people, it's sitting out there and blocked. Well,
and that's another thing that you really have to think about. Because, like, thinking back on my hunter friend who goes out all the time fishing, hunting, he fishes too, but we're talking about hunting. So a lot of what he will do is the tracking,
mm-hmm.
But he doesn't hunt at those times. He goes out during the day and he looks for deer sign.
Right.
And looks at the trees, the type of trees that the deers will go for because they eat the specific nuts of the tree. And then he will set up deer stands and stuff like that. And then he will go like really, really early in the morning, like practically midnight.
Right.
He'll go up into the tree stand and he'll wait for dawn when the deer are just getting up and they're just starting to move around, and that's when he'll do his hunting.
Exactly. Now, for those, since I imagine there are probably more hunters in our audience than fishermen, just because there's more areas that have large quantities of woods than there are that have large quantities of water, that's essentially how fishing works too. You go out, If you are a serious fisherman, like my grandfather, for example, you know, or my cousin, people who do this regularly and for long periods of time, you know, you go out, you figure out where fish are likely to be hanging out.
Hey, fish, fish.
Yes, exactly.
Hey, fish. Fish, fish, fish.
But you go out where you go out where the fish are. You figure out various things. You get a vague idea of what the water looks like, of where various hiding places for fish might be. And then you figure out, okay, well, this place is probably going to be full around at 8 o'clock in the morning because, you know, the light shines really bright here, or the light's really dark here, or there's a bunch of hiding, you know, there's a big log here which they could probably hide under. And then you get, like, figure out what the fish is like. So here, this has sort of been percolating in the back of my mind. I think that the way you make a real fishing game, an interesting and more realistic, let's say, fishing game, is you basically make it like Pokemon Snap.
I was thinking you should make it like Ridiculous Fishing.
Well, we're going to get to Ridiculous Fishing. Okay. I think we should close that. But Ridiculous Fishing already is what we're talking about. It is mini game fishing. I like Ridiculous Fishing quite a bit, but I mean, that is basically Stardew Valley mini game fishing taken all the way to the most extreme conclusion. Mm-hmm. Because instead of throwing it, it's a joke take on it, but it is taking it to the most extreme humorous conclusion, which is you throw in a line, you try not to catch fish, it gets to the bottom, you try to catch as many fish as you can on the way back up, and then you shoot them with a machine gun.
or a rocket launcher. Rocket launcher.
Well, of course. Everybody likes the rocket launchers. But that's what I mean. It is that style of mini game fishing blown all the way out to the most extreme, insane, crazy end, which is you're trying to catch and rack up thousands of fish at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So I like Ridiculous Fishing, but that's the extreme other end. That's all that is the reeling it in part. No, but I'm saying if you want to do a game where it's more than just the reeling the fish in, you make it kind of like Pokemon Snap, where you have, say, the 50 great lakes of the world, or the 50 great oceans of the world. Or
greatest, maybe, don't call it great lakes.
Yeah, I'm just going to think of the 50 great lakes. The 50 greatest, like a hunting game might have the 10 great hunts. You know, mm-hmm. you have the 50 great fish, you know, and, you know, you might do, like, the Loch Ness, you know, do some places that everybody kind of knows. I don't actually know how many fish there are in Loch Ness, but, you know, you pick some places that are really cool, have really good views,
mm-hmm.
so that when you're playing, you actually have something cool to look at.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you start out with, say, 5 or 10 baits, and you have to start, you know, and you go out, and you start trying to figure out, well, I could catch these fish here. And I could probably this is how I would do it. And then, you know, you can obviously cut out some of the waiting around. You know, you don't have to sit there for 5 hours staring at a blank screen. But here's the other thing that a lot of people tend to forget. And I know that to some extent fishing shows use pre-stocked ponds. But, you know, if you watch fishing shows, if you watch people who are actually good at fishing, they're not sitting there for half an hour or 45 minutes.
No,
they're catching a fish every 10 or 15.
Well, because that's the major difference. When I said that, like, one of the things that I enjoyed about fishing was just sitting there, that's that weekend warrior thing. They're doing it to relax. It's their way of relaxing. Right. They're not there to catch fish. But when you're there to catch fish, and you do use the techniques, you do the research, then you will be catching fish.
You'll be catching a lot of fish. And also, and I think this is a major misunderstanding from a lot of people, if you're actually really, you know, unless you're catching certain kinds of fish, which don't like bait that move, like some of like largemouth bass tend to be quieter fish. They don't like things that move a lot. Most fishermen who are actually going out to fish are reeling their line in probably every 2 to 3 minutes. You're not leaving it out there to sit for a ton of time.
They're like testing different positions,
exactly.
Different locations. Like, oh, let's see if I can swing something past this log over here and catch something to tension. And they'll do that, and then they'll do it again
I think an actual fishing game would be much more... I mean, maybe
it would be faster paced than a lot of these mini games that we see.
In fact, I feel like the irony of this is I started this thing out by saying you shouldn't always go for realism in cases where you shouldn't be going for realism above interesting thing. But in this case,
a fishing game, that's the major difference there. A fishing game would actually benefit from more realism, being more of a simulation.
Well, I was going to say
because that's what most fishermen are interested in.
I was going to go with a slightly different tack, which is, the more that I'm talking about this, the more that I'm realizing the problem is too many people don't actually know the realities of fishing.
So they can't actually duplicate the actual experience of fishing, right, because they don't know it well enough.
And the quote that I use in my article, and I may have to rethink this, is, you know, I think Bruce Garrick made a really interesting point once about World War II strategy games, which is most people don't want realism in their World War II games. They want it to feel like the things that they have seen in movies and read in books, which probably isn't 100% real, because storytelling always dramatizes things.
Yeah.
So unless you're...
But
in the case of fishing, the things that are interesting are the things that most people who actually go fishing will never see, because they aren't good enough at it. In much the same way as skateboarding games or soccer games.
Well, you know, when you point that out, especially about the whole World War II thing, you're absolutely right. Because if you think about it, barring the instances of people who relive trauma from, like, Saving Private Ryan, I know there was a couple of instances in that where someone went to see Saving Private Ryan. They had been in a war.
Yeah.
And it actually caused major flashbacks
that set
them back decades.
I can understand that. That's a really intense scene.
And that's the realism of war. There's a ton of kids who go to military, and they join the military, and then they end up going to someplace like Afghanistan back a couple of years ago. And the fact was their impression of war was what they see in, like, Call of Duty and these other types of games. When they got there, despite the fact that they're American soldiers, which I will arguably say are the most well-defended soldiers out there, the death
level
soldiers.
Probably the best trained.
Best trained, well defended, they had armor, they had everything going in their favor, going up against people who were, you know, they knew the land, but they were pretty much under-equipped in comparison.
Yeah,
and they were still coming back horribly traumatized
by
what they saw and what they did, because
killing people is really hard.
Real war is nothing like you see in TV.
No, absolutely.
You're absolutely right there.
But I mean, even beyond that, he was talking about, like, you know, it was specifically about tanks and how tanks don't actually take hundreds of hits the way they do in video games.
Oh, no, they don't.
Tanks don't have hit points in real life.
No, they don't.
They have, you know, one or two hits. And that's what he was talking about. It's like, aside from the most grognardy of grognards, most people don't want full-on realism. But I think in the case of this, it's not so much lack of realism as it is lack of research.
Mm.
It's not that people don't want a more realistic fishing game. In the same way that I think in some fantasy games, people don't want a more realistic game. What they want is a game that feels more like what they've seen or what they think about the world.
Yeah, it's still
but
that.
But with fishing, so few people have that. You know, when we talk about writing, we talk about writing what you know. And I feel like we've gone 18 different places with this thing, but I feel like this is a really... This is what I like to think of as more of a learning exercise in this one. You know, we're sort of talking about this as a way of getting at other topics. You know, I feel like there's really a write what you know sort of thing with things like fishing, because most people don't really know that much about fishing. Mm. And fishing is way, you know, it's like golf. A lot of people are like, golf is super boring. Golf is actually really interesting if you play it a lot. You know, hunting is really interesting if you play a lot. Fishing is really interesting, or play a lot, if you do it a lot. You know, once you get beyond the very surface level stuff, there's actually a lot of interesting things going on in most hobbies.
Yes. And getting to... And it's so hard. Even something that seems like on the surface, like going into this, I was even thinking, oh, there's not going to be that much to talk about with it when it comes to fishing. But even just what's come up in my own head, there's so much, like, subtle detail in something like fishing that it's really hard to sum up in just a handful of words.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's true of most hobbies. And maybe this is actually what people say when they say they want more realism, is they want more research. Maybe this is the thing that we should ask, is please, when you say realism, be careful about what you're actually saying. But as far as our fishing game goes, I think that's one way of doing it.
Research would be it. Not realism, but research.
Research.
A good understanding of the mechanics.
A good understanding, but also remember that, you know, again, there is more to it than just the catching and the reeling. And that, you know, the fun part of it, or the fun part for the people who really love it, isn't... I mean, sure, part of it's the excitement of catching the fish, but it's also the research, it's also the planning, it's also the preparation, it's I mean, my grandfather goes to fishing stores and looks at lures and gets excited in the same way that I do when I go on the Steam store and look at video games. He's like, I bet if I used this in this spot, I could catch this fish. The same way that I look at a video game and say, oh, I bet this has this cool thing that I would like to try doing. Because, you know, he's seeing it in his head, and that's how he thinks about it.
Okay. So I think we could probably put together a pitch for this. I've got some pretty good ideas.
All right. Well, I've pitched one, so now you get to pitch one.
I'm thinking of building off of what you've got.
Okay.
With the Grand Hook, but I'd love to see kind of like an expansion of the basics that you saw in the Zelda minigame.
Yep.
Where you've got the same concept where you could actually choose different means of locomotion. Either you could stroll the banks or you could get a boat, varying different types of boats, which mm-hmm. would have different effects. Like if you used a motorboat, you could get around the larger lakes easier, but it had a higher chance of scaring away surface fish. Stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Something with some depth there. And then you get to choose all your lures.
Yeah, and that one actually has some really good, I believe that if you have anything that adds things, you should also have things that, you know, have a trade-off there. And I like the idea of motorboat being, which is also realistic, but, you know, having the trade-off of the faster you move, the more likely you are to scare fish.
And a more focused viewpoint with the fishing where, just like Legend of Zelda, when you cast, you kind of like your camera stays on your hook.
Yeah.
And you can actually see the fish in the water in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to do the same thing with that, so you can see what, if you're even getting a reaction, and you show, like, if you're like, oh, I kind of cut the fish's interest, but it didn't work out this time, maybe I should try a different lure, so that you can see what kind of reactions, and you can also see what kind of fish you're passing up. So
I would actually say that should be, if I was doing it, I would actually make that, I don't want to say necessarily tied to skill level in the sense of, like, character skill, but sort of a, you know, you have to get, like, say, polarized sunglasses. Like, you can get a little bit, but, like, the more research you do, the better equipment you have, the better able you would be to do that.
I was also thinking of having, including a career mode kind of financial situation in that, wherein you would make money doing your fishing, kind of like, oh, it would be like a pro sports fisherman, where you're actually, like, say, you're fishing all the great lakes, like, greatest lakes, like what you thought, which is actually a great idea. Every time you fish a lake, you're doing it for your show, and so the more fish you get and the better scenes you produce,
mm-hmm.
the more money you make,
cool. Yes.
And then you use the money to buy equipment. So your upgrades would be financially, because, like, in the real world, that's what happens as a fisherman. You have to spend money to get better equipment to fish better.
Yes. Actually, making it a fishing show actually removes several things. So first of all, that gives you a reason to have the camera,
mm-hmm.
because it's no longer first person. You're actually the camera guy.
Oh, I just pulled that whole financial thing out. Even better, you don't have money in it. It could add an extra challenge because, it'd be like, Hooksalot really wants you to show off their newest lure, and then you read into it, it's like, it's designed to catch bass. So you have to actually pick a location where you think you'll do a good job catching bass.
Well, I was just going to say, make it more like the Kerbal career mode.
Yeah.
Where, I would say make it like, you could almost make it two separate streams of income, where one is fans. Instead of making it a television show, because who cares about television anymore, you make it a YouTube show.
Oh, and it's like a viewership.
So you're trying to grow your viewership, and at the same time, you're getting YouTube revenue, so how many viewers you have increases that. But also, you get sponsorships, you get... You might say, hey, look, this lake over here, way more lucrative than, you know, going to this lake, which is really dangerous and really challenging, is going to get me more viewership, which is going to pay off more in the long run than doing this little dinky thing for this lure company.
That's the other thing is like every day
right.
that you do, like every day you do a video,
every show.
Right? Yeah. And so, like, you have so much income from your last one, which I think viewership wouldn't be a major thing. It would be enough to, like, cover the expense. There'd be an expense to going to a location.
Yeah.
Because there would be in reality.
I feel like,
and
it
then,
should be.
And then on top of that, whatever extra money you have, so that you'd actually have to do
sponsor. I think
sponsor.
You could balance it reasonably, yeah.
Yeah. But it would still require you to do the sponsor stuff, because one, when you do a sponsor thing, you're given the device to use on that specific show. And on top of that...
I like the idea of making it a... You know, not forcing the person into it. I like the idea of making it a hard choice. Like, so some of them, like, especially, or what you do is, maybe you have multiple sponsors, and if you start using one sponsor regularly, they get more upset if you don't use them the next time. So, like, if you do three requests for a sponsor, and then the fourth time you're like, well, no, I have this plan instead, they get really angry at you.
Oh, you know what? It would even be interesting. If you're going with the YouTube shtick, this would add an extra level of difficulty, having sponsor popularity.
Yes.
Like, so if like, I don't know, turns out that this one company, their parent company, happens to be, like hunting whales.
Yes.
And it comes to light, and you use them as a sponsor, it would actually hurt you, because their popularity is low, and your sponsor...
I feel like you have to be careful with stuff like that, because the instant that turns into a, you got screwed without knowing why, that's mean.
That
you
know, is true.
If there was a way of doing that where you could do research into your sponsors before you use them,
I would think that each sponsor would just have like a big popularity bar. And
yeah, sure.
It'd be obvious because it'd be color coded.
Sure, I was just gonna say yeah, and I think you could occasionally have it change, but I feel like if you suddenly went from these guys are super cool to boom, no negative popularity overnight, that could. I think you can do it occasionally, but I feel like you got to be sparing with stuff like that. Because people will immediately be like, you're just cheating. You know how that
right.
goes.
Yep.
But, you know, yes, I mean, that happens in real life, so I don't necessarily have a problem. But yeah, I think that may be the most full pitch we've gotten out of this yet.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is actually a game I really want to play now. Actually, that's not fair. Our first pitch, ironically enough, I was just saying this to you the other day. I realized... a couple days ago that we accidentally wound up pitching Astroneer, which is a game that we actually both really love.
Yes. Actually, keep your eyes out. I will most likely be doing a reviewish on Astroneer.
I'll be doing a text review as well.
You want to do the written review?
I'll do a written review if you do the reviewish. But yeah, no, I don't even really want to play fishing games anymore, but I would definitely play this one. This actually So here's the secret, developers. If you want to make a game more fun, make it more like Pokemon Snap.
or you know, just look to Nintendo and Twilight Princess, because they've always got good ideas there, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. Everybody hates Twilight Princess, but they have a few good ideas in there.
Nobody, that's not true.
I really like Twilight Princess. A lot of people didn't like that one.
There's a lot less people who are actually into Twilight Princess than I'm actually agog. Although, I hear that there is a stronger fan base for that game than you would think. A lot of the loud people.
I feel like all of the Zeldas like get popular 5 years after they come out. Same kind of thing happened with Wind Waker. Everybody, once it stops being the 12 once the 12-year-olds suddenly become like 18-year-olds, they suddenly realize, oh, that game's really good. And then all the people who were 18 when it came out and didn't like it because they're too old for it all become like in their mid-20s and like, oh, that game's really good. So, you know, everybody just kind of grows up and they just everybody loves one Zelda generation before they were a teenager, which is why I love Link to the Past. But we are not talking about Zelda. What we are talking about is fishing here on Tangent Cast. I actually think, I need to stop saying I never say when I'm doing public speaking, but I say it on the podcast all the time. So I think what we're getting at is that our basic pitch here is a Pokemon Snap style game where you're going to go around to 10 or 20 or 50 different things. You're going to be running a YouTube show or a television show. You know, take your pick. And the thing is, it's going to be two parts. There's going to be the part before your YouTube show where you're going to go to the lake and start figuring out where you want to go on your show. You're going to have to do the pre-planning, the research, the figuring things out. And the more research you do, the more stuff you look into, the more stuff you start to pay attention to, the better chances you will have of catching fish onto the show. So if you start, if you do a bunch of research into habitats, that might pay off in one way. If you do a bunch of research into the water type, that may pay off in a different way. I think you should have two or three different kinds of things you can pay attention to. And then whether that be, I feel like you have to limit it some way because you can't just allow the player to do everything.
I think it's maybe important. Time limit or something. There'd be balancing with that. I think it would also be, besides time, there's also content. You probably, like we could say, you release a video every week, and so you have a week's worth of time to invest in whatever
so you
plan
could do
it
like,
is.
So I'll almost do it like Princess Maker style or something, Persona 4 style, where you have like 5 days worth of stuff, so you can do like two things each day. So
yeah,
you can check 5 or 10 things or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, and then you have the show in which it's going to be a half-hour show, so you have X amount of time, and say, so, you'll be throwing and casting about 15 or 20 times. You'll be doing it in this, that, or way. So, you know, you're still having the excitement of casting and reeling and casting and reeling because it's a YouTube show, so you can cut out most of the boring parts, and then it becomes a game about strategy, about time management, and then you finally get that payoff at the end of, I'm gonna catch a fish. The kinds of fish I catch matter. And even after you catch the fish, because here's the other big problem that I've always had with fishing games. And the reason that I always hated fake fishing games is, what difference does it make whether or not I catch a big fish beyond personal satisfaction? But if catching a good fish pays off in viewership and pays off in sponsorships, you now have a reason to go fishing. So having, having a YouTube audience, having scholarship or sponsorships, that solves the problem of there's no reason to actually catch those fish because you can't eat virtual fish yet.
I've tried, it doesn't work.
Yeah, one of these days with 3D printers.
I just ended up with bite marks in my mouth, so.
I thought you said bite marks in your mouth. That was way weirder.
No, mouse.
Yeah, so that solves the problem of not being able to bring your catch home. You still have something to show about, and then you can post your best catches on your Facebook wall to brag to your friends, and we'll even give it the built-in feature of allowing you to scale it up 10%.
How meta will it be when people are actually playing our game as Let's Plays on YouTube? About playing a Let's Play on YouTube, fishing on YouTube. That's just so meta.
So
meta. It hurts.
So there's your pitch. So game developers at home, because obviously neither of us are actually good at programming. We leave all of our pitches to you. Though if you do make money, please send us a small, 5%, 10%, 50%, 100%, whatever, up to you. We leave it as a donation.
Yeah, send us a little bit of gratitude or, all of the money. That's a good balance right there.
Hey, they're intelligent. They can figure out the appropriate amounts. I figure if they can do it for balancing the gameplay, they can do it for balancing the money. But, yeah, so I guarantee you that if that game comes out, I will play it. So, developers at home, you have your next challenge this week on episode 4 of Spitball Sessions, and we're going to take a short break now.
I would like to say, if you have anything that you would like to say about this past Spitball that we've just thrown together for you, I highly recommend, instead of sending us an email, drop us a line in the comment section of the podcast. There is a comment section there on our website, neoncheetahs.com. That would be the best way to get to us. We will respond far more quickly to that because we see it on a regular basis.
Although I do check our email inbox as well.
Oh, good. Good. So you can email us, but send us
a podcast. And how can they email us?
They can email us at either
spitball.sessions@gmail.com or
spitballsessions@neoncheetahs.com.
Perfect. Thank you very much. And with that, we are going to take a short break, and we will be back in a few seconds with the mouthwash.
Cheetah's fun fact number 1. Trevor's favorite part of fishing is the scaling, gutting, and deboning of the fish. He finds it quite therapeutic. He also enjoys butterfish and long walks on the beach. It's time for the mouthwash.
And welcome back to The Mouthwash, where we spit fiery hot truths like arrows from the bow of Lady Justice herself. I have no idea what that means, but it sounds really cool. Along with just a hint of Josh is glaring daggers at me over there, because he wrote this and I'm ruining it for him. We're keeping that. We're totally keeping that. All right, so yes, fiery arrows of truth with just a hint of minty freshness. That is the mouthwash. So it's just a general discussion with a overarching theme. Today's theme will be difficulty bleed.
I just want to point out, I was not glaring daggers. I was just trying to figure out where you were going. I was very confused.
Well, I'm sorry. I never know where I'm going. You should see me trying to record my review, which is I just go all over the place.
I feel like, well, this is probably not the time to bring this up, but since we were talking about you getting not ever knowing where you're going, you once went to visit your cousin and what, given off, took a 3-hour detour because you got lost one road before his. Yep.
Well, no, it was in the local city. I had to pass through. There was a detour, and I was lost for 3 hours. Yes, that is entirely true.
Another one completely derailed us, or you've completely... Somebody has completely derailed us.
Anyway, let's begin with what we usually do here on The Mouthwash. Josh, what have you been playing recently?
Well, okay, so I've actually been playing a few things. One game that I was playing a little bit of... then I got to a really hard part, so I stopped for a little bit, is Final Fantasy XII. And I'm not going to say too much about Final Fantasy XII, aside from the fact that I still really enjoy power leveling in that game more than I actually enjoy playing that game.
Now, I haven't really been playing much Final Fantasy since 10, honestly. Yes. So is 12 the one where they changed over to the new mechanic?
No, that's 13.
That's 13.
12 is the one that basically played like Final Fantasy XI, except all your party members are AI controlled.
Oh, no, that's the way
okay, yeah, yeah.
Where they, well, where they changed 13... over the mechanic to more of an MMO style, yeah, with the direct animated.
Yeah, and, you know, as somebody who likes playing MMOs quite a bit, you know, it's nice to be able to just sort of run around for an hour or two and pick up a ton of cool loot.
You know what's kind of funny?
And it was really cool, and the one thing that's really cool about that game is you build up chains. So the more you kill of certain similar monster types, the better your chain does. So it encourages you to not just fight every monster you come across. Mm. So that's really cool. And also, here's the other thing that I will say about this game is... Remember when inverting your x-axis wasn't an option?
Yeah.
That's really annoying. I forgot about that.
Yeah, I think I've actually played 12 a little bit. I might have actually borrowed it from you or someone else.
Yeah, I know you played at least a bit. Well, I bought it because you showed it to me.
Oh, it might have been that. And there was some stuff that I liked about it. But I have a persistent problem with the Final Fantasy, especially the new Final Fantasy titles.
Yes.
And that's my wife.
Well, yes.
She is...
Well, we're going to have your wife on episode seven. So,
oh, yeah. She's a great gamer. She's fantastic. But she's supremely old school when it comes to Final Fantasy. Yes. And so it's kind of odd because she doesn't think that like Final Fantasy XII is a Final Fantasy game. But I honestly think because she loves... She should love that concept, the fact that it is MMO style without other people, because that's what she really likes.
Right.
She doesn't want to have to deal with other people.
Well, she could just play the .hack games. They're basically the same.
That's true.
They're also not good, but they're the same.
.hack's, the whole premise of it is being in an MMO.
I didn't like .hack very much, but it's basically the same idea.
The early one was okay.
And another game that I've been playing a ton of, and man, do I like this game, Puyo Puyo Tetris, which is a Japanese-only game. I imported it because I found out recently that PlayStation 3s are not region locked, or the PS3 is, but the discs aren't, or I forget how it works. But basically, you can play region. The discs I think are region free, so you can play Japanese discs on your PS3. And here's something that I'm going to tell you, and you're not going to believe this: Tetris still really fun.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Tetris is one of those timeless games.
Puyo Puyo I like, which if people haven't heard of Puyo Puyo before, is a Japanese game similar to... It's like a mix between Columns and Puzzle Fighter. So you're basically dropping colored cubes to try to make bigger blocks of that color. And then if you drop them in like chains, you get... So if like one color falls into a group of that color and makes enough to... Take it off the board, you get a chain.
Is that usually the ones that look like little blobby guys, and if they're the same color, they kind of like...
Yeah, I've heard of Puyo Puyo.
That does look interesting.
I like Puyo Puyo. Tetris is still way more fun. I really love Tetris, so playing... Like, it's a mix of Battle Tetris and Puyo Puyo. It's really fun. You and I are going to have to play that at some point, because it's really good.
That sounds like a blast.
And I also have played... I'm still playing a ton of Total Extreme Wrestling, still playing it like every night because I just actually did a brand split because I have too many people. But I played a bunch of Forsaken Isle, and I want to get back to that. We'll revisit that again in a later episode. But
is that the city building game?
It's a 2D top-down sandbox game.
Oh,
I think your wife has played a little bit of it.
I think she's played Forsaken. It's not Forsaken Isle. It's the one where you're like building a city, like a village. I don't think it's the same game.
I don't know. I saw her playing my copy of it for a little bit.
Oh, maybe she has tried it. Okay.
So I know she's played like half an hour.
I'll have to try that because I think I know what game you're talking about.
It's really cool. I did a stream of it, so you can check that out.
I should.
On my YouTube channel, youtube.com/Gaholos.
You pushed it over to YouTube?
I think that one I did, yeah. I put most of them on YouTube if I think they're worth watching. But yeah, it has some cool ideas, especially about things like crafting. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's quite there yet. It's still in early access. But I feel like that game could shape up to be something really neat. I'm not ready to say run out and buy it yet. But I think they are trying some interesting things. I don't think they all work, but I think they're trying some cool stuff. How about you? What have you been playing?
Okay, well, I got a bit of a story to tell you about.
Oh, boy.
So I upgraded my computer.
Oh, wait, sorry. Real quick, speaking of stories and things I've recently been playing. So you were a little bit late this morning coming to the podcast session. Uh-huh. So I was playing some Dungeons of Dreadmore while I was waiting for you.
Yeah, I saw you close that out.
And I was, I died with one character, so I started up another character called Luke. I'm playing with some really fun stuff. I got some really good skills, but about 10 seconds after I got the text from you saying that you were going to be a little bit late, I picked up a pair of clogs. So apparently Janiel says hello.
Oh, you don't know anything about the clog story, and you never, never will.
And by you, he means the audience.
Yes, I'm talking to you people.
Okay.
And if Janiel, if you're ever listening to this, it's still an awesome story. We love you.
Yes. We miss you, Janiel.
Yes, we do. Okay, so my fun story is, as you know, around the same time that you upgraded your graphics card, I upgraded my computer in its entirety. So, funny thing about upgrading a computer without changing your OS, drivers get really nasty.
Yeah, no, I know. That's why I wound up having to switch all the way over and having to remove all of my Windows 7 stuff and switch over to Windows 10 when I did mine in March.
Yeah, so I
3 hours before I was supposed to go live on a stream, I should point out.
So, so I did that. I ended up having to wipe my entire Windows partition. And then, of course, it turned out that it was because my RAM was clocked up too high that was causing all my
problems. Oh, jeepers.
So that was... And the funny thing is I got RAM that was supposed to clock to 1866, I think was what it is. I had to drop it back to 1600 because the RAM, even though it's made for it, wasn't handling it. Yeah, it might be my motherboard.
Mine's the 2333. I kicked my thing again. Sorry, Trevor.
So, what ends up happening is, when I did a reformat, a couple of interesting things. First of all, I had mentioned in my last podcast that I had recorded all that video for Undertale.
Yes.
I hadn't gotten around to finishing it.
Is it all gone?
Well, my save file was lost.
Oh!
Because I did not know that Undertale does not update your Steam Cloud.
No.
Update to Steam Cloud. So, I had to delete them all and start from scratch again. Which
You should have kept it and just played up to the point where you left
off. I should have, but I had another reason why I didn't want to do that, which was I did not know that I when I first played, because I'm doing a complete blind playthrough, and spoilers here, and my first run through, I killed Toriel.
Well, you should have stuck with that then. That would have been really interesting to see.
I'm kind of regretting it now because one of my friends who actually bought me the game and got me a webcam so I could do this for him because he wants to watch me play it. He's upset now because I deleted all my videos and I'm feeling really bad because it was like it would have been great.
I mean, now you have spoiled it for yourself.
I have kind of. It's terrible. I really regret it, but I'm still gonna put it up. I think
the poignancy of you doing that and not realizing what you had even done is actually way more interesting.
I know. It's terrible. I feel really
bad. Especially if you saved it and then we could compare and contrast your playthroughs.
Anyway, because it was a fresh reinstall and I have my Steam
Luke,
directory...
I'm so disappointed.
I'm sorry. I really am sorry.
You might be able to recover them.
No, I've deleted this. Oh. I've deleted the videos now, so they're okay. They're lost. What was I gonna say? Okay. So I have like 12 games on my system now.
Is that all?
That's it. I haven't I'm kind of playing the rule. If I want to play something, I'll download it and play it.
Yeah.
One of the first games that I downloaded because it's been a while and I was kind of in the mood was
I have like 180 installed on mine.
I know.
Because I'm a hoarder.
That's about where I was. I was actually think I was hitting 200 installed games.
Yeah. I'm something of a hoarder just because my download speeds are not great.
Yeah, well, I usually just keep them because I have a full terabyte to fill up, and I wasn't even halfway there.
There's that.
So Dirt 3 was what I've been playing a ton of. I started from the very beginning, and it's still a really good... I think I'm going to have to pick up Dirt 4. They just announced that it's coming out.
Oh, nice.
And I'm going to have to get it, and I think I'm going to do that all on Twitch.
Here's what I will say about Dirt 3.
Mm-hmm.
If you play with the volume off, it's a good game.
You don't like the sounds of the engines?
Oh, no, I have no problem with the sounds of the engines. Oh, I have people talking. Real trouble with the people.
Yeah, and you know, it's kind of annoying when they're like, Luke, you're so awesome! Dude, I rolled the car 3 times, and just because the people I was racing against were so stupid, I still managed to get first. And it's not so much the... this is a good way to segue into the actual topic of it. The difficulty in that game on its basic setting when you start up the game is not that good.
No.
And it may just be because I'm really good at driving games, but, like, I own every single race that I play.
I think it partially is that, but I'm not very good at racing games, and I can beat it on even on the medium settings.
Maybe I should... Okay, so this is what's going to happen. I'm going to save up. And it's going to be really hard because I'm also saving up for the Switch. I'm going to save up. I'm going to get Dirt 4. I'm going to stream it live. And what happens will happen. And I'm going to turn up the difficulty and see how the higher difficulties
are. Yeah, I mean, what difficulty are you playing it on now?
Normal. Whatever it starts out as.
I was going to say, because on easy, I can... Like, you know the checkpoint races?
Uh-huh.
On easy... I could pass a guy and still be on the tail of the guy rallies, in front of him.
Okay, there have been
so
times.
You're so there you have being been times better than me, you should be rallies, at least on normal.
On the setting that it just defaults, which I usually just leave whatever it is, because that's usually my assumption is that's what the developers wanted you to play at.
Yeah.
And so on those rallies, I will pass 2 people.
Okay. Well, like I said, you are better at racing games than I am. So I will usually be on the tail of the guy. I will pass one guy and be on the tail of the guy in front of him. I will usually be about 4 seconds.
And it really depends on the race and what happens. But, and I will tell you.
So yeah,
right
I would say play it on hard, and you'll probably be right where you want to be because you beat me in dirt when we play it multiplayer.
Well, we should play that multiplayer too. Now that especially because they re-released it using the Steam interface. It's not using the Windows one.
Should.
It's so fun. Much better. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Like I said, for me, the problem is I'd have to get through the 20 minutes of intro garbage. Or maybe not. I may still have the save
file. It's not that bad. It's not that bad.
I just...
Dirt 3, you might be thinking of Dirt 2, because we used to play Dirt 2 with the wagon.
No, it's the one where you're... Oh, maybe it is Dirt.
Yeah, because Dirt 3 is different. It's not as bad. I mean, most of the time, when you start...
Oh, okay, I'm going to change my thing then. I'm really good at Dirt 2. Dirt 3, I'm not actually very good at. I find Dirt 3 a lot harder.
Really?
I don't know. Which one? Is Dirt 2 or Dirt 3 the one that has the extreme sports?
Dirt 3 has Gymkhana.
Okay, then it's Dirt 2 I'm thinking of.
Yeah, because
Dirt 2 is the really annoying
Dirt 2 is the one where you're in the wagon. You're you're touring across the country.
I am terrible at the Gymkhana.
I hate the Gymkhana.
I'm terrible at drifting in that game.
I mean,
I'm
getting better at it. I usually get gold.
Yeah.
And I want to get platinum.
I usually almost get bronze. So
it's just it's kind of annoying because it's like you get used to like doing bombing down dirt roads at 50 miles an hour and sliding through snow and stuff like that, and then they make you do Gymkhana and it's just like completely
precision.
Yeah, it's
well,
are you
using a controller or are you using a mouse?
I use my Steam controller
because I have real trouble feathering the feathering the brake properly.
It's good with the Steam controller. I don't think the triggers are the best in the world, but...
Maybe I'll try it with the Xbox, because I was trying it with... Or no, maybe I'll try it with the PS4 controller now that I can use that.
The newer controllers might
Xbox triggers, I always find, have too much throw on them.
You can... Okay, so this is something else I wanted to talk
really
about.
It amazes me that everybody loves the Xbox 360 controller. I hate it so much. I hate it! It's so loose.
Are you using an actual Xbox 360 controller, or are you using the Afterglow one that I gave you?
I'm using that one. It's
not going to be as good as...
But
like
even the original ones, I always found them loose. Like, I find the PS4 controllers feel very tight. Or the PS3 controllers, they feel... You know, the sticks move, feel very tight. The controllers have a lot less give to them. They have a lot less dead zone, and I always find that the Xbox 360 feels very loose and very sloppy.
So the big thing about the Steam controller, which you might not care for, is I find that the triggers are nice and firm, but they're short.
Well, that's actually what I like. That's what I like about the PlayStation is it has much shorter triggers. Like the Xbox triggers are so there's so much give on them. But the other my biggest problem with the Steam controller is, and I, you know, at some point I'm just going to have to buckle down and play with one for a few hours, but the trackpads still throw me off.
Well, I mean,
but that's probably for another.
You don't have to, because okay, so I've always been like a huge supporter of the Steam controller. But what really made it great to me was the customizability. That made it, like, it's a good controller, and I like it. But what would make me buy it over an Xbox controller or a PlayStation 3 controller was the customizability. Mm. But now that Steam supports... Okay, somebody actually got a Wiimote through Bluetooth hooked up to the Steam system.
Nice.
And it worked.
Nice. The PS4 controller... I actually have a little bit of a problem with the way that they're handling the PS4 controller as far as customizability, because they keep trying to treat it like it is a Steam controller.
Well, that's the entire plan, so that you can adjust anything. Right. Or do you mean that the inputs change?
Like, it keeps trying to treat the left analog stick as the trackpad, which doesn't work. So I can't... So it wants me to, like... When I'm trying to type with it, like, it keeps wanting me to, like... rub my finger along it like a mouse, and I can't do that because I don't have a trackpad there.
Oh, you're talking about the trigger or the
No, the thumb. It keeps trying to treat the left analog stick as if it's a trackpad.
Oh, okay. Well, you know what? What you might need to do is actually change that.
And sometimes
setting.
It doesn't. And sometimes it ignores the D-pad, and other times it's better than it was. It's
they're working
work.
On yeah, it because yeah. They just started implementing that, and they're you know they're fiddlers yeah, yeah. And they'll fiddle with it.
Also. Steam, guys, you have to fix the controller supported interface. Not the part where it's controlled by a controller, the part where it says whether or not a game is controller enabled. You need to fix that, because half of the games say, I have a dozen games that use controllers that say they aren't controller supported. Mm-hmm. Like Stardew Valley says it is not controller supported. Phantom Brave says it is not controller supported. There are some games that say that the games that are partially controller enabled don't show up when you filter by controller.
Okay, there's a couple of things that you have to know about that.
Mm-hmm.
That's just an indicator.
Oh, I know.
That doesn't change anything, because like that's all. I think when it says it's controller supported, it's Steam controller supported, which means that it actually takes advantage of the major API.
I actually think it's a setting that the developers click, which is can you run the entire game without ever having to touch a mouse. The Witness is technically partially controller supported because the dialogue box that pops up at the very beginning, you can't use a controller
for. That might be a lot of it. I think they do have specific requirements that a game has to meet.
And like Stardew Valley technically is not controller supported.
But I can actually use a controller.
Right.
But there are times when I just have to use
but
a
it's,
mouse.
But it would be really nice if it would have a controller enabled, partially controller enabled, Steam controller enabled dialogue. Because there are a lot of games that it says are controller enabled, but they mean Steam controller enabled. Like, I'll tell you what. If a game is part, if a game like say Civilization says that it will work with my Steam controller, it's not going to work with my PS4 controller. I don't care how customizable the PS4 is, even if they do the full Steam interface, you cannot play Civ 5 with a PS4 controller. It will not work.
You can't play Civ 5 with any controller then.
You could play it with a Steam controller. Because the trackpads work like mice.
Well, I will argue the fact that you have to actually adjust the settings to make it work. But,
right, but I'm saying you don't with the trackpad where you could touch it and rub your finger along it, you have that precision. You just don't have that precision at all with a analog stick. Because it's a one-to-one where you touch the surface of the trackpad and your mouse will go to that point. You can't do that with a PS4 controller.
It doesn't work. Well,
even
I don't...
The middle bar almost will, but even then it's not quite sensitive enough.
Yeah, it depends on the setting. The fact of the matter is their system is so elaborate that...
No, I know. But what I'm saying is, again, they're 80% of... It's the thing that always happens with Steam is I always feel like Valve gets 80% of the way there and then they just stop. Like, they're 80% of the way to being perfect, but like when I'm on my couch and I'm trying to filter through the games that I can play on my couch because I don't want to get up and go over and, you know, trigger everything, like, it's really hard to tell on a glance, like, whether it is or isn't. Like, it's trying to tell me Silent Storm is controller enabled. Like, you couldn't even play that with a Steam. Like, you technically could, because again, you have a trackpad, but you really, even with a Steam controller, that game would be, you know, XCOM, any of those kinds of games are going to be rough playing. Well, actually, XCOM, you can't.
XCOM, I mean, made
old XCOM.
Yeah.
Rough, you know. Ooh. You know, at least Civ has, like, Civ, you technically could play with a keyboard without even a mouse. You technically could do it. It would be rough, but like your units will move with a key, with the arrow keys, you know, etc. Mm-hmm. You know, Dungeons of Dreadmore, you could play. It would be rough playing something like old Echo. It would be rough playing any of those sort of old strategy games.
Yeah, because they were made for one type of interface, and that's mouse and keyboard.
Right, and they were made for a mouse and keyboard with the precision of a pointer.
Anyway, so...
Yes. So, Steam, I love you guys. Just please iron that one little thing out. Just like controller-enabled, like Xbox controller-enabled, Steam controller-enabled. That would be all I'd need to see. Like, will it work with a regular controller or your controller?
Yeah, I think what they should they should have a kind of an indication of that it supports a controller or it supports the API.
And then allow me to filter by fully enabled, partially enabled.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Anyway, so we wanted to actually talk a little bit about difficulty in games and how some developers do it, how they do it right, how they do it wrong.
And I was just saying to you, it's going to be funny because we're going to be basically talking about difficulty in games from various tacks for the next three mouthwashes, because we have this one, we're going to be talking about Bullet Hells next time, and then you and I are going to be, and then your next one is about Massacre. So, you know, all three of our next three mouthwashes are going to be about various different looks at difficulty. But I think today you were talking more about, like, well, you have here in our notes difficulty bleed, which I don't know what you mean by that.
Well, you know, it's kind of a tough thing. I've seen a lot...
Sorry, guys, I shouldn't be throwing a peek behind the curtain that we have notes, but we have notes.
Yes, not very good notes. My notes are terrible. So, anyway... So my concept of difficulty bleed was kind of that. Oh man, it's been so long since I wrote those notes. So in a lot of games, you have a variety of different difficulty settings.
Sure.
But what some people would think of as like normal difficulty isn't exactly accurate.
Okay.
Because we could use as the segue into that Dirt.
Okay.
Their idea of like the difficulty that you start with is, in my opinion, supremely easy.
Yeah, I'd say it's somewhat easy.
It's not like challenging to race against the AI, and like other games have that same problem. So Dirt has their concept of what their normal difficulty is, and then you get into something like Gran Turismo, where their normal difficulty is still supremely hard.
Right.
And that's a lot to do with the fact also that there's a huge
Ironically, a lot of people say Gran Turismo 5 is way easier than Gran Turismo 4, and I'm going to argue that it's because a lot of people played a lot of driving games between Gran Turismo 4 and Gran Turismo 5.
Yeah, well, there has been kind of an influx of racing games between... Because, like,
especially like 4 Forza.
And 5 were, like...
10 years apart,
yeah,
just about.
There's a huge amount of time, and in that time...
And all of the Forza games came out between them.
Yeah, and the Dirt series kind of, like, yeah, cropped
well,
up.
Well, I think I specifically mentioned Forza because I feel like Forza is a slightly more beginner-friendly version of, like... Forza starts you out a little bit further down on the difficulty curve by sort of helping you understand how some of this works. And then it goes to the... Like, the end point of Forza is still about the same place as the end point of Gran Turismo, but it starts you a little bit further down the ramp. Like, Gran Turismo already assumes you kind of know how to drive. Forza assumes you don't know how to drive, and let's start from there.
Right. So, like, a lot of what I was thinking of, now that I'm thinking about it more, is just the fact that... I added in the notes the words, the challenge of challenge.
Right.
And making something, like, genuinely difficult without being frustratingly
difficult
is hard.
Are you talking, like, cheap difficulty? Difficulty
is a good word for it.
I think it is hard because I think it depends on the genre. And what I mean by that is, like, Let's take Legend of Zelda: A Link to the Past as an example, because we've talked before about how I really love that game.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked before about the fact that there is one boss in that game that I hate. The butterfly boss.
Okay.
Because you are on a moving platform or a bunch of conveyor belts, and then every so often a spiky block will come flying across the screen and smack you if you aren't paying attention. And that is the only game, and that is the only boss in that game where that happens. Right. Or if we're going to a topic that we talked about earlier today, you know, the Stardew Valley fishing game. Similar idea, where all the other things in that game require one kind of mechanic, and then suddenly the gameplay style changes for the fishing mechanic. Likewise, yeah. in Link to the Past, you start, you know, all the other bosses are, you figure out why this boss is weak, and then you go and attack it in that weak point, and you dodge some things, and it's all player, you know, it's, if I can read this boss's patterns, I can kill this boss. Right. I can kill this boss without getting hit. Like, you know, you and I had a challenge, or your brother and I guess, had a challenge at one point where who could make it through Link to the Past on their first playthrough without having played it before with the fewest deaths? And I beat him by like 5. But, you know, a lot of that is scouting weak points, figuring things out. And if you can figure out the weak points of a boss and the boss's pattern, you can beat any boss in that game without even getting hit.
Yeah.
Except the Moth boss, and the one whose head you have to cut off, and they all fly around. Because the Moth boss, even if you're focusing on the Moth, the stage itself is moving around.
Yeah, and it can put you in a position where you can't even evade.
Right, and the caterpillar does that a little bit too. But even then, like, if you know what the boss does, which is if you hit its head, you're going to bounce backwards. You can set yourself up in positions where you're not going to bounce off the stage.
Yeah. So, bosses are another area where difficulties, like you said, there's...
I didn't actually take my point to the logical conclusion, which is, so I think a lot of times what we mean, you know, this fake difficulty, this difficulty bleed is just from changing the mechanics of, here's 80% of the game plays like this, and suddenly we're going to change it up because we don't really have an idea for this, but we gotta pad it out just a little more because it's too short. You know, we said there's gonna be 8 dungeons in this overworld, or 9 dungeons in this overworld. We have good ideas for 8 of them. But we'll just put this in and this will be cool. You know, we had a really good idea for these things, but we don't, you know, I think part of the problem, and I actually feel like one of the reasons we see this less now than we did in, say, the Nintendo era is A, interfaces are better and controls are better, but B, we don't feel the need to pad games as much.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about a game like Bastion, which I love Bastion. I think you like Bastion.
Bastion was very good.
I don't feel like there is any cheap difficulty in Bastion.
No. That's one of the big things that's important in having fair difficulty is having good mechanics to execute what you want.
Well, I think it has good mechanics, but I also think, I don't feel like there is... Well, I guess maybe you could say the last minute and a half of that game where you're surrounded by enemies on all sides, but that's a dramatic. Well, okay, that's a dramatic arc.
Bastion's challenge as the game progresses is smooth, even though it gets really, really hard.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, the last 30 seconds I died because you're surrounded by all those guys. But the whole point is you're supposed to die, so that's intentional.
You died there.
That might be a spoiler. Maybe you aren't supposed to die there. I did die there the first time when I was carrying what's his face.
Wow. I mean, I dumped all my potions and stuff, but I survived.
Oh, maybe I didn't use a potion.
Ah.
So, I thought I could make it through without using a potion. I thought it was scripted.
Well, I thought it was, too. Well, which is very interesting.
Yes. But I think it is, to some extent. So, you may have to, Bastion, but what I mean is, doesn't feel like any padding in that game. That game feels like they
planned it everything from the beginning.
That was good and cut out everything that didn't need to be there.
And there was moments in that, and there was like a fluctuation in the difficulty as well, because I remember towards the end game, I mean, there was areas where it was super challenging,
yeah.
But at the same time, they gave you tools to deal with it well. So it was not so much as they were just making it harder, as they were just changing the formula and seeing how you handled it, essentially. Which is not bad, which is a good way to say, you know, we're not just going to keep adding bad guys until you can't handle it anymore.
Yeah, and there were parts where I died because I was just... It was asking more of me than I was able to give at that moment. But, yeah, I mean, is this... So a lot of people like to say that the difference between fair difficulty and quote-unquote cheap difficulty is it feels like it's your fault or not. And I don't necessarily think that's always true.
Because
the reality
really.
Is, in real life, there are times where you are going to fail to do something despite the fact that it's not really your fault. And that's not necessarily cheap. That's just the way life works.
Well, yeah, but in a narrative world, it's something like that, which isn't exactly a difficulty issue. It has to be, if it's going to be a situation like that, it has to be intentional. Because,
I don't necessarily think so. For example, we talked about Final Fantasy. If I take a level 1 character into a world that is, into a level 25 zone, I'm going to die.
Oh, yeah.
It's not, you could argue it is my fault, but if I just wind up there by mistake, it's not necessarily my fault, I just didn't know where I was going, you're still going to die. It's not necessarily your fault, but it's also not cheap. It's following the rules of the world.
Well yeah, but in that way, it sort of is intentional, yeah. Because you're not in the place that they want you to be.
Well, sure, if we're talking about... Well, I think that's the difference, right, is we're talking about intentionality of design.
Yes.
But the problem is, I think a lot of people just take it to mean, well, if I don't feel like I did anything wrong, then obviously it's the game's fault and it's cheating. Which is funny because I feel that way a lot about the game Dark Souls, and everybody else says that game is, anytime you die in that game, it is always your fault. And I have real issues with that, because there are things in that game that you have no reason to believe are there.
And okay, so a lot of the mechanic of Dark Souls, for those of you who haven't played it, with the two of you,
yeah,
in our giant crowd of, three people?
Yeah, right.
Those of you who have not played Dark Souls, it's actually a lot of trial and error. There is a lot of not failing to meet, because it's like there are save points, right, and you're trying to advance to the next one, and there's you will die a lot in the progress, and that is kind of built into the game.
And there's a lot of and it is a cross between a brawler and a roguelike, and the first time I heard it, people kept describing it as like Diablo, but a roguelike, and it's really not it doesn't play like Diablo at all. It plays like a fight, it plays like Shadows of Mordor or Assassin's Creed. It plays more like one of those kinds of games, like an action game, like a Zelda game,
like a combat simulator almost. In that way, you engage stuff.
I'd say for a rough thing, it kind of plays like a harder Zelda or a more complex Zelda.
Yeah, well, the combat is like that because like every engagement that you're in, all the creatures have tails, they have different patterns, and the trick is learning the patterns and defeating them before they defeat you. So there's a lot, and that's where the trial and error comes in, because you have to face up against something, usually a couple of times, especially if it's something big, because the game is also very unforgiving.
It's very unforgiving, and it hits really hard. But there are also, monsters, most of the time when you die, it feels like it is your fault. There are also times where I have died to creatures, could not figure out why, had no reason to believe that I should have done the thing that you actually are supposed to do. Or there are times where you wind up in bad situations. Or, for example, such as like the mimic chest, or there are some falls where everybody's like, well, you shouldn't have jumped off of there if you hadn't been able to properly scout to see whether you could land below. But there are places in that game where it looks like you could safely jump, can't safely jump.
Yeah.
Or there are places where it looks like you can't jump, that, oh, it turns out there's actually a secret prize down there. Or there are exploding traps. There are things in that game that you should not have any reason to believe are there, and you will get killed by them at least once. Now, you could argue that that's, and many people who like these games do argue that, well, that's just there to teach you to be more careful and more observant, and, if you'd been all of these things, which, fine, you like Dark Souls, I get that. But I feel like there is actually several parts of that game that are not just, well, I clearly didn't do things right. And, the people who are the hardest Dark Souls advocates will say, well, the difference between Dark Souls 1 and Dark Souls 2 and 3 is that every time you died in Dark Souls 1, it felt like your fault. And Dark Souls 2 and Dark Souls 3 didn't. And I would argue that that is actually more because these people were not as good at the game and were more willing to forgive it for the first Dark Souls. And for Dark Souls 2 and 3, were less willing to forgive it because they knew what they were doing.
Like the way you're describing this game, which I've played very little of, it does seem a little bit like the situation where the developers are kind of trolling their player base.
Oh, absolutely.
With those situations, trying to put their players in situations where they actually don't have as much control over the situation.
Right. I mean, it is absolutely them. I don't necessarily want to say trolling, but definitely messing with player expectations. Mm-hmm. And they do it in the later games, and that's why people say that they feel like the later games aren't as much your fault, is because they feel like the developers are trolling you. Well, the developers have been trolling people since the very first game, and that's arguably why some of that game even exists. Mm-hmm. You know, and yeah, the fan base surrounding Dark Souls is always kind of confused and frustrated me, because everybody who has beaten that game says it is the most difficult game you will ever play. Many of the people who haven't beaten that game will say that it is the most difficult game ever.
I don't agree with that.
And I don't, I mean, I will admit, I have not beaten the game yet. But it's, if you are careful, and you are playing correctly, and you are observing the bosses, you can eventually beat the bosses. It is a challenging game, but I don't really feel like it's, I mean, it is a difficult version of that kind of a game, but I don't feel like it is certainly not the most difficult game I have ever played.
What would you say would be the most difficult game you've ever played?
I'm actually trying to figure that out as we're talking about this.
Put you on the spot, didn't I?
Yeah, I know. And I feel like I could say original XCOM was the most difficult game I've ever played, but I don't think that's fair.
That's a hard game, yeah.
It's hard, but I've also never... I never really tried.
Hmm.
I think this is actually where we get into the problem, right? And this is actually a problem that I kind of have in real life, too, where once something seems really hard until you beat it. Or, you know, art seems really hard until you're good at it.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
I thought using Photoshop was immensely difficult. Like, I was like, oh man, the fact that people can do things in Photoshop is incredible because that's so hard to do. And then I learned how to do Photoshop, and I'm like, Photoshop's easy. I don't see why anybody thinks that's hard.
Well, that's one of those easy to pick up, hard to master things.
Right.
But, actually, you just reminded me of something, another direction I wanted to go with the whole difficulty thing, and that was Homeworld.
Mm.
Because, actually, that is an idea of difficulty bleed, that a direction I want to go in with that. So if you're not familiar with Homeworld, it is a space strategy game using a three-dimensional region where you can.
It's actually more 2D than it looks.
No, it's not.
I mean,
not,
you can move up and down, but you can't. It's not quite 3D the way I want it to be. It is not fully 3D.
You can manipulate your ships in a 3D environment.
Yes, but you can't.
But you're like, you have a plane that you work on.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's not full 3D in the way that, like, Descent.
It's not like multi-orientation kind of thing.
It's not Descent.
It's actually really good.
And it's a real-time strategy game.
Yeah, it is.
Yes. I know. I'm just saying that's worth bringing up.
So, in the game, as the story progresses and as you're playing from mission to mission, it has a system in place to adjust the difficulty based on the amount of resources and ships that you have.
Yes.
And it gets really aggressive. And it actually gets excessive to the point where they actually had to repatch Homeworld 2.
Right.
And in fact, I think they made the mistake of when they did the new Homeworld remaster, they did not implement the balancing that was in there. So the same problem was there. But it literally was... I remember a specific late mission in Homeworld 2 where, because I play aggressively and I always try to overwhelm the enemy forces, I usually wouldn't lose too many ships, which would mean that the game would be calculating with a very high ship count on my end, and it would counter it with ridiculous. It would give each ship a value, right? It would calculate your total value, and then it would populate the next level with ships meeting or slightly exceeding.
Right. Yeah, wasn't like the actual optimal strategy to scrap all of your ships and then jump and then rebuild them all on the next level?
If you had the time for that, that would be one of the ways to do it. Well, in this mission, you would have to actually kind of like rush jump anyway. So I had like two battle cruisers and a bunch of stuff. And so you're supposed to be going to a target destination and destroying it. But like halfway through the mission, the enemy forces would jump in a fleet. And it would, like, spawn jump that fleet. Mm-hmm. And it would be based on your numbers from the beginning of the thing. So you've done some combat. You've lost some ships. And it would literally be that even if you were rushing back because you knew when the jump was going to happen, I think I was hit by two battle cruisers at once at my main ship. And the problem with it is also, and this is something I took advantage of in multiplayer, the battle cruisers of the opponents, they're like... big weapon, because the battlecruisers had a big gun that did tons of damage. And for that fleet, their main gun was super powerful, really, really powerful, and it was front-facing. So when it jumped in, it would just fire these, they're called Trinity Cannons, and take away half of the health of the mothership in one volley.
Jeepers.
And then just tear it to shreds the rest of the way. There's nothing I could really do.
Right.
And I actually had to go back a level and change my technique to try to beat it. And I don't think I actually beat it before they patched it.
Oh, wow.
Because it was that bad. And it was them trying to build difficulty, but in such a poor way that, like, I think a lot of times the self-adjusting difficulty is always a bad idea because of difficulty bleed.
Well, I...
Because it will oftentimes calculate a solution that is unbeatable. In this case, it was literally unbeatable. It was actually beyond what the developers were planning to do.
Sure, but at some point, is it possible that it's just your strategy, your meta strategy is bad?
Well, there was some of that, and I was. But, I mean, and this is something that actually arrived in Homeworld Remastered. They made a similar mistake, miscalculating the amount of damage that a battlecruiser would do.
That's a bug.
Well, yeah, it was a bug, but it was a similar kind of bug where it was a numbers failure.
Sure, but the difference is, like, that's clearly a bug. That is, they miscalculated the damage when they were recoding it. What I'm saying is, you know, in an actual battle, in an actual war, an actual commander is not going to be running around with massive amounts of troops. You're going to run around with a bunch of small troops and then be able to bring in reinforcements to trick the enemy into attacking you where you look weak. So, following standard war strategy, they were playing right. Well, you had a massive force, they brought in a bigger force.
No, well, okay, so... So in realistic war strategy, you're correct. However, and I'm kicking the table this time. However, remember, this is not a simulation.
No, no,
it's
I know.
A game.
No, no, no. But what I'm saying is, there are alternate strategies of, you know, your meta strategy is.
Well, I mean,
I'm not saying it has to be realistic. But what I'm saying is.
I mean, the overarching logic of that,
did you know in advance that that's what they were doing?
No.
When you
jump into the game, and the way that the game is designed, the idea is not supposed to be like, the game is not built with it, because it's a slow-moving tactical game.
Right.
So, like, you'll spend 45 minutes in a single mission.
Right.
So, it's not like Dark Souls, where the idea is you die and you come back and you die and you come back and you keep figuring it out. It's supposed to be you get into a mission, you see what's going on, and you try to deal with it as
sure.
best you can. And what they were doing with that essentially is like you jump into a situation and it's supposed to be manageable, and they were suddenly dropping something extremely unmanageable.
Although,
literally to the point where I sent one destroyer.
Mm-hmm.
To the target site to trigger the spawn and still lost.
Okay.
Because my whole fleet, even though it was there, where they jumped in.
Wow.
They
Yeah, but
that was another issue that they had. So
I mean, yeah, and again, this is obviously clearly bugged stuff.
It's not like their logic was bad, because in a military experience that is sensible
right.
to take advantage of a situation where you can find a weak spot and exploit it.
Although I would also argue that to some extent a real-time strategy game is not that different from Dark Souls, in that I feel like you are to some extent supposed to die or fail and retry
yes,
the mission
but not,
with more experience.
Not always.
No.
You're supposed to.
I mean, in this case, it was obviously unwinnable, because at some point you got to a point where you couldn't backtrack far enough to fix it.
Ultimately, you know, they corrected it knowing that it was a mistake.
Sure.
So that argument does actually fly, but you do argue the fact that, I mean, it does make for.
I mean, I feel like
bad.
They were on the right track. They just obviously overcompensated a little too much.
Exactly.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, again, at some point, bugs are bugs, right?
Yeah, but I think my point is that that's not an uncommon failure, and
sure.
not always a bug failure, because like. I'm trying to think of other examples of that. Running into any game where, I mean, like you have up to Dark Souls. I'd say Dark Souls is the very extreme of what is acceptable excessive difficulty.
Sure.
I don't think it's a bad place.
Going back to Dark Souls a little bit, and this is why, you know, and to some extent I feel like I'm kind of begging the question on Dark Souls a little bit, because you know, I've been going sort of running through my brain as to games that I would consider more difficult than Dark Souls. And a lot of them are more meta difficulty than... But the thing is, like, Dark Souls, like, individual encounters, not that challenging.
It's when you hit the bosses that it really
gets hard. Bosses are hard, but bosses are hard in a lot of games. I have died more on bosses in games that in Zelda games than I have died on some bosses in Dark Souls.
I do recall, and I think I watched someone who just started a playthrough, or actually, I didn't even see the whole playthrough. It was a single segment that they kind of showed off for the laugh of it.
Right.
Wherein there is a dragon boss that you're not actually supposed to engage, but it was a simple, stupid thing where you're crossing this bridge, and you just have to know to get off the bridge here. If you don't get off the bridge here, you die.
Yes.
And there's a lot of situations.
That's one of the ones that I'm talking about, is the fire-breathing dragon. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. But here's the funny thing. Anybody who has played that game will know about that boss. And they'll all be like, oh yeah, I remember that. I died there like 3 times before I figured out what I was supposed to do. But, you know, you should have known that it was like that because you see all... You know, I've actually seen people say, but you should have known that that was there because you see all these charred knight corpses there.
Mm-hmm.
That's not your failing.
No. Yeah, because, I mean, the logic is there. They set up that scenario, and it's again goes back to the intent.
Yes.
The developers set up that scenario with the understanding that people look at a game like that.
Right.
And the developers were actually telling you something right there. They were saying, be observant. Because they gave you the clues.
Right.
You didn't look at the clues, and you didn't put two and two together, and you suffered for it. And that was the message that they were saying. They're saying, if you don't pay attention, if you're not being observant, you're going to suffer.
Sure. But what I'm saying is...
But, they do it at the very beginning of the game, before you even understand what's required of you.
Right. Well, and also, the way that it is set up, it doesn't look any different from...
anywhere else.
Not even that. It looks like... what's the term? Where, you know, it looks like set design. It looks like dressing. Like, yeah. It's just like, oh, there was a big battle here, and a bunch of people died. Oh! You know, It doesn't feel like I did, you know, when I died there the first time, I'm like, I didn't do anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't playing stupid. I wasn't up against a boss that I didn't read his tells properly. There was a dragon that flew out of the sky. And yes, sure, I should have looked at that bridge and said, oh, there's fire, there's charred corpses here. But why would you ever think that?
That was exactly, in some ways, from a difficulty standpoint,
and
annoying standpoint, it's there.
Yeah.
But in some ways, it's good. It's not good design, but it's good storytelling. Everybody who goes through that does the exact same thing because they think the same thing. They think it's only set design. It doesn't mean anything.
And that's sort of what I mean is, to some extent, I think it's things like that that lead to the... I'm almost going to say it's almost Stockholm Syndrome with that game, where people... I've been through it. It's a shared cultural experience. We've all done it. We all died to it. We all see the next person come along. We're like, ha ha, you idiot. You should have seen that.
Yeah. And Stockholm Syndrome is exactly it.
But that is not, as people who love that game claim, that is not... you could argue it is fair difficulty. It's certainly not player-created failure. That is the developers trolling you. And I think that's a lot of what you're talking about with this challenging lead thing.
Yes. In that particular case, well, it wasn't, because I had a point and I can't remember it now.
Well, I'm gonna bring up one other item, which is microtransaction games, which is where I feel like this has been coming a lot. I was talking with a coworker a few days ago, and she's been playing this game called Word Brain, which I really like. It's a like a cross between like a word search and a like a jumble. So, like, it's these jumbled words that you're trying to find, and when you find them all, they will, like, the words will, like, drop down Tetris style. And
oh, yeah, I've got a game similar to that.
It's sort of. Not like Spell Tower, but similar. But, so, like, it's a full grid. Like, it's like Boggle. But
okay.
The words, like, slide down as you solve the words under them. So you're trying to get certain letters to drop in so you can make the last word. But if you have difficulty, they are absolutely happy to let you pay a dollar, or like 10 cents or 50 cents or whatever it is. You know, they give you X amount of hints, and each hint adds one letter to the word. Now, when you get to later levels, there are 30 or 40 letters in a grid.
Okay.
Or there's like, you know, the biggest ones I've seen is 64. I've seen 64 letters. So if they fill in one letter in one word at 50 cents, or I think it's a five pack of hints for a dollar, so 20 cents. Mm-hmm. And she was saying that there was one day she went through $5 worth of hints to solve one puzzle.
That's kind of ridiculous.
And what I said to her, and my own personal view on games like that is, when you have reached the point where you have to spend, not all games, because some of these games I like, but especially with a lot of these free-to-play games, things like, you know, your Plants vs. Zombies, your Candy Crush Sagas, your various popular games like that. When I reach the point where I feel like the game is being stacked specifically to make me spend money, where I don't feel like it is my fault, where I feel like the random number generator is set up in such a way to ensure that you that even if you play optimally, you cannot win more than X amount of X percent of the time. And there was a new game that came out recently that was like, what's the old game where you like Puzzle Bobble, where you like bouncing the balloons Angle? Off the wall? No, it's like where you have the big thing of balloons, and you like, it's the old Neo Geo game where you
like bounce balloons. Oh yeah, Bubble Bobble.
It's like Puzzle Bobble.
Yeah.
And I'm really, really good at that game, and I have been really, you know, like arcade, like in the arcades, I would set high scores. I'm good at that game.
Yeah, my wife loves that game.
I got to level 25 in the iPad version, could not progress, went through the same level 6 times, just was not getting the colors that I needed. And they're like, well, if you pay us 50 cents, we can, you know, or a dollar, we can give you this thing that'll allow you to pop all of these balloons on the stage for a whole stage. No, because that's, you were clearly just stacking the RNG against me to ensure that I will pay you guys money.
Yeah.
And that is not... That is difficult to believe. That's cheat. That is in my mind cheating, because essentially it's some, you know.
I wouldn't call it cheating. I would call it abuse of the system.
Well, if you know that there, like, you know, it was like 15 screens stacked top of each other. If you know that 5 screens up is the first time that this color even appears, you should not be giving that to the player at the start, because there's literally no way that they can hit
them. No,
because,
well, the mechanic of that game has always been that you're given what you need to get through.
Right.
Even if it's slightly randomized.
Yeah.
The system is supposed to be designed. So, for them to set it up so that you can only, when you start advancing far, they make it harder and harder to encourage you to spend money.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that they are literally not giving you the colors you need at the start.
Like, monetization of games is always a tough thing.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, those, like, Candy Crush Saga does it the same way. Like, I got to a certain level of Candy Crush, and even playing optimally, even knowing I need to do this, or Two Dots was one that I've started playing recently as well. Same thing, like, the layout is identical. It will always drop the exact same patterns. Like, if I replay the stage, it always starts through the same grid. They change the colors of which colors are where, and the colors always drop in approximately the same pattern. So, I played the same level 4 times, made the exact same moves all 4 times. 3 of those times I lost.
Hmm.
Because they are changing the way that the colors come out to ensure that you can't do certain, like, if you can match a full square, you can do that, you know, it pops all the colors in that, all of that same color on the screen at that time. So they are literally stacking it so you can't do that to ensure that you lose X amount of times, because once you drop down below 5 hearts, then you got to pay money to get more hearts, or this, or, you know, there are lots of ways to do that kind of stuff, and that stuff is cheap, that stuff is bad, and that stuff is eventually going to lead to, you know, I know that I understand, they're chasing whales, they're whale hunting, but you know what happens if you chase the whales too much? They go extinct.
Yeah. And that's always a problem, because, like, you know, the main reason, and this is a logic that a lot of people have to realize, those free-to-play games with the monetization model built in, the reason that the developers are using that model is because they expect to get more money out of their players overall than just selling it with a single price point.
Absolutely. And ironically, even if hundreds of people play it for free, they still make more money.
And that's not to say that there aren't people out there who do things. Like, there are some developers out there who will make a game where it literally is like, you can play so many times a day. If you want to play more, give me some money. And that's fine, because that can be generally fair, as long as they're not stacking it against you, as long as you're getting some play out of it.
I don't even necessarily have an issue with the you know, pay us for help, pay us for I don't like the paying for reusable items, but I don't necessarily have an issue with it.
I think it just leads too often to people abusing the system.
I have no issue with developers trying to get paid for what they do. I think people should make money for the things that they do. I have no issue with people saying, well, here's a good way for us to make money. It's when it starts getting into customer abuse. It's when it starts getting into, you know, that these people just want to play this game. Like, give them a level at which they can say, well, I'll pay this much, and then give me all the hints I want. Give me all the help I want. Let me do what I want. You know, even if you make it $60, even if you make it the price of an actual console game, you need to allow people to have a maximum price point, because that is unfair and it is abuse.
It is.
And that is going, that, I think, is my final verdict.
Yeah, that sounds like a good place to end. Thank you so much for watching. Blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. Give me just a second here. All right. If you have any questions, thoughts, or pitch ideas, please send them to us at spitball.sessions@gmail.com. Or you can send it to spitballsessions@neoncheetahs.com. Check out our writing and other articles at neoncheetahs.com. You can find me at twitch.tv/thegel or at thegel on YouTube. You can also find my good friend Josh here, the amazing man that he is, twitch.tv/Kaholos or at Kaholos on YouTube. You like how we pick names at work?
That's K-O-H-O-L-O-S. It's really easy to remember. Three O's, three letters.
I'd like to thank our editor-in-chief and sound engineer. I can totally talk, I promise. Sound engineer Trevor for editing the podcast. And I'd like to thank, again, Josh for joining me. I'd like to thank all of you at home for listening to another exciting episode of
Spitball. We are mechanics for you. We're working round the clock like R2-D2.
I said Spitball.
We're getting down in the dirt, and then we'll keep on working even after it hurts.
I said Spitball.
This has been a Neon Cheetahs production. Our wonderful talent here.
Josh Noyes and Luke Goulet. And of course, me, the marvelous Trevor Howard Marvel as producer. We'd also like to thank Brent Ronan and Amy today for being so supportive along the way. Just want you to know the cheetahs always prosper. And this was made by gamers for gamers. Only you can prevent bad games. Buy responsibly.